From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Intrigued me that these women in a time where women did not have public lives down there, did not get involved in politics, and in a country where nobody did that because everyone was terrified of the dictatorship, these women founded this underground. And it was the same underground that my father was a member of.
They were four sisters, and they dared to speak out against the Trujillo regime in the Dominican Republic. Three of them were killed. Today, we speak with author Julia Alvarez, who tells their story. Ariel Sharon, the architect of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, is now saying Israeli troops should leave. What does that mean? And more on the plutonium in the Cassini space probe. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As Democratic National Chair Donald Fowler frequently contacted federal agencies for party donors pushing the causes of a fugitive, competing Indian tribes, and a banana magnate, Fowler admitted as much in a sworn interview with Senate investigators in May, and he faces unfriendly questioning today on his government contacts at a hearing. The Associated Press obtained a copy of the interview. The former party chair did not acknowledge in May that he contacted the CIA on behalf of Democratic donor Roger Tamraz, wanted in Lebanon on embezzlement charges. But Republican investigators on the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee were expected to confront him with documents indicating he contacted the CIA on behalf of Tamraz, who sought and received invitations to White House events with President Clinton. In one July 1995 memo, which is among 22,500 Democratic Party documents recently turned over to the committee, a party staffer warned Fowler not to help the Lebanese-American businessman because of his background. Tamraz has denied the decade-old embezzlement charges. In his May deposition, Fowler defended his efforts for donors. He said, as the chair of the party, I felt that within the good bounds of common sense propriety, that was something that I could do appropriately, and I did that. I did it on several occasions for donors and not donors. Democratic Party guidelines prohibit officials from promoting the interests of contributors with government agencies. This news from South Africa. Five South African policemen who beat black activist Steve Biko to death in 1977 in one of the apartheid era's most brazen crimes will ask tomorrow for absolution from the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The white former officers decided in January to come clean, marking one of the biggest successes yet for Nobel Peace Laureate Archbishop Desmond Tutu's Truth Commission as it tries to expose human rights abuses and heal the wounds of apartheid. During his life, Biko gained prominence as a torchbearer of black consciousness in South Africa, but it was his brutal death at the hands of security police inquisitors that made him a world-renowned icon of the anti-apartheid struggle. If the five South African policemen do tell the story of how they killed Steve Biko, they will be granted amnesty. An oil company has won permission to drill an exploratory well in the nation's newest national monument. Conoco, the oil unit of DuPont Corporation, owns drilling leases in the newly designated Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah and was granted a permit for a single exploratory well in the Kaiparots Plateau. Stephanie Hanna, an Interior Department spokesperson, said yesterday the application was approved after officials reviewed hundreds of public comments. Clinton established the 1.7 million acre monument last September during his reelection campaign, blocking development of one of America's largest known coal reserves. He made the declaration by invoking the 1906 Antiquities Act. The action stunned Utah officials, including the governor and congressional delegation, who complained they were never consulted. Medicare has issued new sales guidelines aimed at protecting the elderly for companies gearing up to offer more managed care health plans to senior citizens. Among the rules, health plans aren't allowed to use promotional gifts worth more than $10, such as magazine subscriptions or meals, to lure senior citizens to marketing events, reward them for low use of services, or encourage them to stay enrolled in a health plan. The Vatican today issued the definitive Latin language version of its Universal Catechism, in which the Roman Catholic Church comes closer than ever before to calling for a ban on capital punishment. While the latest version retains the Church's teaching that the death penalty is still acceptable in the rarest of cases, it said circumstances where it is the only way of protecting society are practically non-existent in modern times. The Latin version of the Catechism retains the Church's teaching that the death penalty is still acceptable in the rarest of cases. It looks like General Henry Shelton will win easy approval in his bid to become the next Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a confirmation hearing today. Georgia Democrat Max Cleland calls Shelton first class and first rate, and South Carolina Republican Strom Thurmond says Shelton's record is impressive and impeccable. The Green Beret is a Vietnam veteran and a veteran of the Persian Gulf War. As thousands of San Francisco area commuters plan for another rush hour nightmare, management and striking transit workers are set to resume talks. But the talks scheduled for this morning in Mayor Willie Brown's San Francisco office are billed as informal talks and not contract negotiations. And the American Red Cross has issued a national appeal for blood donations, warning that two-thirds of its regions have less than 2 days' supply of a critical donor type. You're listening to Democracy Now! That's the news at this hour. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright heads off to the Middle East today. Her trip comes in the wake of last week's triple suicide bombing in Jerusalem and the failed Israeli commando raid into Lebanon. Israel will be demanding that Albright exert pressure on Palestinian President Yasser Arafat to arrest more Islamic militants. Arafat and many Arab leaders, for their part, will be insisting that Albright pressure Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to halt Jewish settlements and keep his predecessor's pledges to hand over more occupied West Bank land to Palestinian rule under the Oslo peace accords. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, rocked by the suicide blasts at home and punishing military law in Lebanon, sought this weekend to quell a growing debate over calls for a unilateral Israeli army pullout from South Lebanon. Israeli security forces were on high alert for further attacks Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's visit. Israeli casualties in Lebanon have spurred discussion even among influential hawks like Cabinet Minister Ariel Sharon of a withdrawal from the Israeli self-declared buffer zone. Last night, I got a chance to speak with Robert Fisk, who is the Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Among his numerous awards, Robert Fisk has been voted International Reporter of the Year by British editors numerous times for his coverage, among other issues, of the Iran-Iraq War and the Iranian Revolution, as well as the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I reached him in Dublin. He's headed back to Beirut, where he has lived for the last 20 years, and asked him about these latest developments of Ariel Sharon, the actual architect of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, calling for Israelis to pull out, and what this all means.
Well, first of all, I don't believe that Israel is going to pull out of Lebanon that easily. Ariel Sharon, of course, is the man who effectively brought Israel into Lebanon in the first place. I think this is very much an attempt at a palliative to popular opinion, because public opinion in Israel is increasingly cynical of the presence of Israeli occupation troops inside Lebanon. But at the end of the day, I don't think anyone in Israel really believes that the Israelis are there for some kind of security zone, as they call it. They're there because, in the event of some kind of final peace deal, the Israelis want to be able to use their withdrawal from Lebanon to make conditions for a new peace. In other words, we will withdraw if we can have access to the waters of the Litani River, access to the Lebanese economy, if we, the Israelis, can ensure that those Lebanese militiamen who worked with us can be given commitments that they will not be harmed, that they can be merged with the Lebanese army, thus, of course, putting effectively Israeli proxy militiamen inside the army of the government of Lebanon. These are all conditions which I think the Israelis would want to impose in the event of the final peace. And if they withdraw from southern Lebanon, there are no conditions which they can demand at all, except for security over the border. And I don't think that's necessarily the priority, and it's certainly not the only priority of the Israelis. So that their presence in southern Lebanon, which does not, of course, provide security for Israel, despite calling their occupation zone a security zone, is effectively a political one. And I don't think that a Likud government at the moment is going to make any kind of withdrawal.
But certainly Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would say, as many Israelis would, that the Israeli security zone in southern Lebanon is there to act as a buffer to prevent rockets from going into northern Israel.
Well, it's not true. It doesn't. There is, in fact, no security in the occupation zone. It's the most embattled part of the Middle East at the moment. And furthermore, as we saw in April of last year, during Israel's so-called Operation Grapes of Wrath, when they bombarded southern Lebanon, there were more Katyusha rockets fired over the occupation zone into Israel in 3 weeks by the Hezbollah than had been fired into Israel from southern Lebanon since 1948. In other words, when the Israelis actually went to war last year in southern Lebanon, they got more rockets than they've ever got before, and they all landed in northern Israel. So it does not prevent those Katyusha rockets. And of course, the great danger now, from both sides' point of view, is that, and the Lebanese too, because they would get the Israeli riposte, is that there is increasing evidence and suggestions, which I happen to believe, that the Hezbollah have now been equipped with longer-range rockets. These are not huge missiles, by the way. These are rockets which you could carry through your living room door and put on the floor, but nonetheless, they sound awful and they can kill, and they're meant to sound bad and kill. They're an offensive weapon. And the great danger is that the Hezbollah, as I say, I believe this is correct, have acquired a longer-range rocket. Now, this means, ostensibly, that they can now fire from southern Lebanon and hit, for example, the northern Israeli town of Haifa, which is much further away than the border. But the long-term strategic danger is that it also means they could hit the Israeli border from Beirut or from the environs of Beirut, which would mean that the battlefield, if you like, would extend much, much further than the area around Israel's occupation zone. The battlefield, in a sense, would become half of Lebanon. And that, of course, pitches up the strategic possibilities and the dangers of war very considerably.
Israel says that the Israeli soldiers that were killed had gone into Lebanon, were raiding it because of the suicide bombing that took the lives, it looks like now, of 8 people, 3 of them the suicide bombers themselves.
Well, I was unaware that Israel actually said that. I know that we as journalists suspect that it was an attempt by Israel to show its muscle after its inability to stop the suicide bombers in Jerusalem. But why they should pick on Lebanon is a bit of a mystery. It's Mr. Yasser Arafat, the PLO leader, who claims that the suicide bombers in Jerusalem came from outside the country. It's Mr. Netanyahu who's blaming the Palestinian Hamas movement, which, of course, is effectively inside the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. So why Lebanon should be made to suffer for the wicked deeds that took place in Jerusalem is something of a mystery. In fact, of course, it wasn't at the end Lebanon was made to suffer, except in a small way, comparatively speaking. I think it's important to point out that always when the Israelis suffer casualties in Lebanon, almost without exception, Lebanese casualties are ignored or largely unreported. And it's important to point out that as a direct result of this Israeli raid, which was an offensive operation by Israel in somebody else's country, a 35-year-old woman and her small baby were killed during the fight in which the Israelis died. So they, too, were casualties. These are innocent people, not soldiers wearing uniform, who sometimes expect to die, whatever their country may be. So, and the other question, of course, that comes up about that particular raid is, what on earth were they doing? They landed on the sea, well north of Tyre, far north of their own occupation zone. They walked apparently 3 miles inland without air protection, carrying explosives on their back in the direction of a village called Ansariye. Now, I know this village, and it's not a very big Hezbollah center in any sense. There is an Amal office, an office of a small and rather ineffective militia there. What were they going to blow up? It now seems clear that the soldiers stumbled into some form of booby trap or roadside bombs left by the Hezbollah. And when one of them set off the booby trap, the explosives on the back of others blew up. In other words, they were killed by the explosives they were carrying on their backs. But we still don't know, and the Israelis haven't said what was their target. What were they going to blow up? Who were they going to kill? And we don't know that. What we do know, of course, is that the unit was virtually annihilated.
We're talking to Robert Fisk. He's the Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, based in Beirut. And he has won more International Reporter of the Year awards, awarded by British editors, than any other foreign correspondent. His first award came in 1982 with his coverage of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Robert, can you tell us how this all got started?
Well, like every history of the Middle East, you have to decide whether you begin 2,000 years ago, with the dispersal of the Jewish people from their land, whether you move the period forward to the rise of Islam, whether you move the period forward to the First World War when Britain, my country, made two conflicting and thus obviously dishonest promises in order to get the Arabs to fight on the Allied side against the Ottoman Empire, which was supporting Germany in the First War. We promised the Arabs the independence of all their lands from the Turks if they helped us. And we promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine, or at least we promised to support such an idea if they helped us. And, of course, these were two conflicting promises, and in the period between the First and the Second World War, they were shown up for what they were, both cynical promises made by the British and, in some cases, supported by the French in order to get other people to fight for us. Then you can, I suppose, say the story begins in 1948, when Britain abandoned its League of Nations mandate in Palestine, and there was, in effect, a civil war between Arab and Jew, Muslim and Jew, when the Israeli forces, who were founding the State of Israel, effectively drove out most of the Arab population from their homes. Of course, the Palestinians would now say that was ethnic cleansing. Effectively, one has to add that the United Nations had partitioned Palestine, and it was the Arabs who had refused to accept that partition, which made war equally inevitable. The Israelis will say that that was the great Arab mistake, and some Arabs would agree with that now, that they refused to accept the partition of the land of Palestine. Then you can move it forward to the fact that the 750,000 Palestinians who were driven out and fled their homes, that they had children and their children had children, and they gave rise to a massive refugee population in a diaspora spread across the Arab world, which now numbers at least 4 million, who are totally cut out, by the way, of the peace process and the Oslo agreements, because they remain in their dingy, filthy refugee camps. And that these people became a kernel of resistance within the Arab world to the existence of Israel itself. And this led to a series of wars, 1948 being the first one, of course, what Israel would call its War of Independence and what the Palestinians call the Palestinian Catastrophe. It led inevitably to the 1956 war, the 67 war, the 73 war, some of which were started by the Arabs, particularly when one thinks here of the 67 war, which effectively was Nasser's doing. Other people would, the Arabs particularly, would claim that there were a number of preemptive strikes by Israel, which effectively brought war about. So you have the 1973 war, and then effectively a long series of wars of attrition across the Suez Canal, inside southern Lebanon, across the Jordanian West Bank border, which the Israelis would say now was effectively the Jordanian-Israeli border, because, of course, they, after 67, occupied the West Bank and Gaza, all the rest of the Palestinian land. And we now come up to today, where after a series of fruitless attempts by the Americans, who more and more have come to back Israel's side rather than being an honest broker, the peace process, in effect, is dead. Nobody seems to admit it, and most journalists still talk in these cliches about putting it back on track, but the peace process is effectively finished. And so we're faced with further disasters, I fear, in the Middle East.
I just want to end with the suicide bombers, the last five in the last few weeks.
Well, we still don't know who they are. But Hamas, the Palestinian, extremist Palestinian group, which still demands an Islamic Republic in all of Palestine, which is something it's clearly not going to get, they certainly claimed that these bombers belonged to them. It's interesting that the suicide bombers themselves, and this applies also to the previous bombing in a civilian area, and you have to remember these are civilians who are being killed by the suicide bombers. Two young girls were among the civilian dead of the last, two young Israeli girls of the last bombing in Jerusalem. They took the suicide bombers before they died great pains to ensure that they couldn't be identified, even to the extent of cutting the labels off the T-shirts they were wearing so that the seller of their clothes couldn't be identified. Now, this either means that they're trying to protect their families because Israel routinely blows up the homes and deports or expels or throws out of their homes the families and the relatives of suicide bombers who are identified, or it means that they came, as Yasser Arafat claims, from outside the West Bank and Gaza and from outside Israel itself. And then you ask yourself, well, where did they come from? We do know that a man who was apparently constructing a bomb in Jerusalem a couple of years ago had come originally from Lebanon. He was Lebanese, and he flew on a false passport from Britain. So it may well be that we're dealing here not with Palestinians themselves or not from Palestinians within Yasser Arafat's area, although, of course, it is the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who are being punished by the Israelis for this.
Robert Fisk, the Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, speaking to us from Dublin. He's headed to Beirut today. He has lived there for more than 20 years. Among his numerous awards, Robert Fisk has gotten awards from Amnesty International, was voted International Reporter of the Year a number of times by all British editors for his coverage of the Iran-Iraq War, the Iranian Revolution, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and other issues. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday on the show, we spoke with Alan Cohn, a 30-year NASA veteran and former emergency preparedness operations officer at the Kennedy Space Center. He's now a defector and a fierce critic of NASA. Both Cohn and our other guest, Bruce Gagnon of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, were in Washington, D.C. yesterday to take part in a news conference to denounce the planned launch of the Cassini space probe, a probe which will be fueled by 72 pounds of highly radioactive and poisonous plutonium. Well, Dr. Michio Kaku was also there yesterday at the news conference. He's a professor of nuclear physics at the City University of New York and bestselling author of Hyperspace, a scientific odyssey through parallel universes, time warps, and the 10th dimension. He, too, is a leading opponent of the Cassini probe, which is slated to explore Saturn's rings and moons. And when he came back from the news conference, I asked him how it went and what he had to say.
At the press conference, I said that this is the mother of all nuclear space launches with 72 pounds of plutonium, but it's also the Cadillac of space missions. It's chock full of equipment that we don't need. It is overweight, and we could go solar. We could downsize the spacecraft by going solar and sending two compacts to Saturn rather than one Cassini mission to Saturn, this Cadillac of space missions. Saturn is not going to go away. Saturn was there for Galileo. Saturn is they're going to be there for us in the future. But if there's an accident, if this satellite comes raining down space debris on the planet Earth, I estimate that 200,000 people could be killed in a maximum credible accident.
Michio, you said that solar could be used, but NASA says that you can't use solar when you're so distant from the sun.
NASA says that Saturn is far away, that it only gets 1% the sunlight of that on the planet Earth, and they're right. But you see, Cassini is overweight by 130 pounds. It weighs 13,000 pounds. It is 1% overweight. NASA's solution is to reject the solar option. My solution is to lose 130 pounds. Why not downsize the mission? If it was good enough for Wall Street, it's good enough for NASA. Downsize the mission, make it smaller than it is, and then send two of them to Saturn, energized by solar.
Why is it so heavy?
It's heavy because it has a 2-to-1 mission. It wants to go to Saturn and also Titan as well, one of the moons of Saturn. But the new philosophy of NASA is faster, smaller, better, cheaper, like the Mars rover. The Mars rover has shown us the way, solar energy with off-the-shelf technology. Cassini is a leftover from the Cold War. During the Cold War, the Russians had nuclear, we had to have nuclear. The Russians had big space shots, we had to have big space shots. In the post-Cold War era, the future belongs to solar missions that are small, cheap, compact, and frequent. That's why I say that this Cadillac of space missions ought to be made into two compacts sent to Saturn.
What was NASA's response at the news conference? You had a tremendous amount of press. In fact, how many people were there?
it was overflowing with TV cameras, as many TV cameras as the eye could see. We had to open up a second room, which is unheard of, in order to accommodate all the TV cameras and the international press. NASA had a small press conference outside to rebut our testimony. Their main statement is that, yes, it's potentially dangerous, but it's one in a million for an accident. Well, I'm a physicist. I can redo all their calculations, and I found the source of this one in a million. It's a meteor impact in outer space. That's a chance of a one in a million. Now, give me a break. In real life, it's not meteorites that have downed our space probes. It's human stupidity. Now, how do you put a number on human stupidity? For example, the Hubble Space Telescope was a billion-dollar fiasco, a nearsighted mirror, because in Danbury, Connecticut, the engineer inserted a ruler in backwards. That was a billion-dollar human stupidity of a mistake. How do you put a number on these kinds of things? You can't. The real failure rate is 1 in 20. That's the failure rate for the Titan IV booster rocket. Now, take a gun with 20 chambers in it, put a bullet in it, and point it at your child's head. Could you truthfully pull the trigger with a gun with 20 chambers in it? I couldn't, but NASA bureaucrats say, hey, let's go plutonium. They could pull the trigger.
You're going after a bureaucracy that really has hardly been touched before. There's very little criticism of it. What do you expect is going to happen? Cassini's already been put off, not because of all your comments, but because of some problem with insulation and the air conditioning. Do you think this is going to delay it even more, possibly stop it?
We're asking President Clinton to cancel the Cassini mission, and I think NASA bureaucrats are very worried. You see, NASA has committed the worst sin that a scientist could ever make, and that is to believe your own press release. They have stated this number, one in a million, so often that they forget that we haven't launched a million space probes to Saturn, and only one has failed. The actual failure rate of space probes is about 20%, not one in a million. I think NASA was stung by this press conference. That's why they had their own counter press conference. And that's why NASA today is trying to bring out PR people frantically, trying to do damage control. Because the future is clear. 12 more space shots with nuclear on board, plus reactors on Mars, plus atomic booster rockets. We're talking about the nuclearization of outer space. Cassini is just the beginning of nuclear power packs, nuclear reactors, nuclear booster rockets in outer space. That's why we're calling on President Clinton to cancel it now, before we nuclearize outer space.
Did you deliver petitions to the White House?
And that's right. We had a vigil in front of the White House, a rally, and then we presented petitions. And now, by the way, cracks are beginning to form within NASA. As you know, Alan Cohen, the man in charge of emergency evacuation for NASA for the previous space missions, has bolted, denounced the whole thing, called it a farce. Other nuclear engineers and scientists are now beginning to consider defecting. NASA gave us a telephone call and mentioned that their great fear is sabotage of the Cassini probe. But we said that we're mainly pacifists. We're not going to sabotage the mission. We'll sit on the launch pad, but we're not going to sabotage the mission. And then the NASA person said, no. We're not worried about you guys sabotaging the mission. We're worrying about our own people sabotaging the mission. The threat is there. Within NASA, there are so many people who don't want this mission to go up. They know that their children, they know that their wives, their husbands will be caught in the middle of a plutonium cloud if there is a misfire on the launch pad. And that's why the greatest fear that NASA has is NASA engineers themselves trying to do something to delay or stop this space mission.
Why is NASA so interested in the nuclearization of space?
NASA is interested in the nuclearization of space because it's cheap, dirty, and quick. It is true. Nuclear is the cheapest way that you can explore outer space. But no one ever said that the quickest and dirtiest way is the proper way to explore outer space. The Europeans have the Rosetta probe that will go past Jupiter to a comet far beyond Jupiter. That Rosetta probe uses only 500 watts of power and is solar energized. Cassini uses 800 watts. That's eight light bulbs worth of power. We're not talking about a lot of power out to Saturn. All of that could be provided by solar if we downsize the Cassini probe.
Well, it's interesting, Michio Kaku, that you and Alan Cohn, who is just, I guess you could say, defected from NASA, Bruce Gagnon of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, this whole group has somehow managed to break through the media blockade. Just a few weeks ago, weren't there 12 people arrested at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C.? The press is there, like they go to the White House. They also have a whole NASA press corps, and almost no one covered those arrests. And yet here you are with two rooms full of reporters.
It just goes to prove that in this country there's freedom of the press if you happen to own one. And fortunately, we own one in Pacifica Radio. But you see, the media, of course, is very gun-shy about nuclear. I mean, NBC, for example, is the Nuclear Broadcasting Corporation. The Nuclear Broadcasting Corporation is owned by RCA, which in turn is owned by General Electric, which, of course, makes nuclear power plants and makes nose cones for Minuteman missiles. And so Westinghouse, which owns CBS, makes nuclear power plants as well. So you're talking about the media heavily controlled by nuclear interests, and that's why they've tried to keep this issue out of the American public's eye. But again, there's one thing more powerful than a NASA press release, and that is the laws of physics. Any engineer who's gone through those numbers know how dangerous, how threatening this probe really is. And now we're beginning to see engineers and NASA officials defect, denouncing this mission in the name of science and humanity.
Dr. Michio Kaku, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York and best-selling author of Hyperspace. If for more information on the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, of which he is a part, as well as our guests yesterday, Bruce Gagnon and Alan Cohn, you can call 352-468-3295. That's 352-468-3295. And their website is www.afn.org/FCPJ for Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. That's www.afn.org/FCPJ. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. We'll give that again at the end of the show. After this short musical interlude, you'll meet some heroines. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! There's been a lot of talk about heroines over the last week with the death of Princess Diana, and I've been thinking about how people come to be known around the world and what they get known for. People like Marilyn Monroe, Princess Diana, Jackie Kennedy Onassis. And I've talked to a lot of people about what for them defines a heroine. For me, I think an element of it is women who risk their lives to make the world just simply a better place. And thinking about that, I thought about the Mirabal sisters. They were four sisters, and they dared to speak out against the Trujillo dictatorship in the Dominican Republic. Three of them paid the ultimate price, cruelly murdered by the regime. They were dubbed Las Mariposas, the butterflies, and they're the subject of Julia Alvarez's book. Julia Alvarez, an author and professor at Middlebury College. It's called In the Time of the Butterflies. Just a few weeks ago, I got a chance to talk with Julia Alvarez at the Breadloaf Writers Conference just outside of Middlebury, Vermont. It's a 12-day gathering where more than 200 young writers gather with professors and writers like Julia Alvarez to talk about writing. We had a chance to talk about her own family, which fled the Trujillo regime. She grew up here in the United States. Apart from In the Time of the Butterflies, Julia Alvarez has also written How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, really about her coming to this country with her own sisters. And her latest book is called Yo. I was first introduced to Julia Alvarez by her book In the Time of the Butterflies, which I read a few months ago. And we started by talking about that, by talking about the four Mirabal sisters.
Well, the four Mirabal sisters, as you mentioned, I grew up with a story of the three Mirabal sisters, because actually the three that were very political and that started the underground in the Dominican Republic against the dictator Trujillo, whom we had for 31 years, were the three Mirabal sisters and their husbands. And they have founded the underground from, you know, scratch, basically. And it intrigued me that these women in a time where women did not have public lives down there, did not get involved in politics, and in a country where nobody did that because everyone was terrified of the dictatorship, these women founded this underground. And it was the same underground that my father was a member of, and he was discovered as being a member of, which is why we left the country in August of 1960. And then 3.5 or so months later, the Mirabal sisters were murdered by the regime. So those sisters had always been sisters, figures that I heard about a lot from my father and from many Dominicans.
Did he know of them at the time?
Oh, of course, yeah. They were very much their inspiration, and their code name was Butterflies, Mariposas. Of the Mariposas was something that I think really energized the underground.
Why butterflies? Why mariposas?
You know, I've often asked myself why they gave them that name. Part of it might have been just in terms of their own name, the Mirabals and Mariposas, that it had maybe a ring to it. But I think that the butterfly has often been a symbol of, you know, emergence from a cocoon and flight. And in the Greek mythology, it's a symbol of the spirit. So maybe that kind of a sense of it being an animal that has that kind of quality to it is what made them choose the name.
When you left the Dominican Republic, you were 10. When did you come to really be aware of them and decide to write this book, this sort of fictionalized account of the Mirabal sisters?
Well, I became aware of them when their deaths in November 25th, 1960 happened. They were reported in Time magazine with a picture of Minerva in the report. And I remember then my eye being caught by it, paging through my parents' Time magazine and seeing that, and it being taken away, and my parents not telling me because they were still afraid. You know, Galindez and other Dominicans had disappeared even from New York City, so they were still living in fear. And then after the dictatorship was toppled, my uncle, who did stay there and was taken and was tortured and was part of the torture prisons when he came out and the dictatorship was over, especially with him, you know, and the men that survived the prisons, I would hear all the stories about the Mirabal sisters. So they were in my head for a long time. But because they were so bigger than life, and the story seemed just such an impossible story to write, I could never have done it as a first novel, for instance, because I needed to feel like I could do a novel, like I would be able to touch these mighty figures. And even so, the story seemed too big for me. And what brought them to life for me, what made the novel start for me, was when I went down to do the research and was told that, sure, the three famous Mirabal sisters were killed, but that there was a fourth sister who had not been politicized like her sisters, had therefore not joined the underground, and was still alive, and had raised the children of the others. And that's when I met Dede. When I met Dede was when they became real to me. And plus, the figure of Dede became very interesting to me. The person who is not politicized at the moment, when it was the appropriate moment, but because of this tragic thing that happens, she becomes politicized only later than her sisters. And so she's the one left behind to be the carrier of the story. And, you know, that idea that the storyteller is also a political choice to not be silenced is, you know, of course, very appealing to me.
It's also interesting that they, the fourth sister, was the one to carry on that story, and yet she was the one least involved with their political activities and least likely, at least when they were alive, that they would have thought she would be the one to carry on the message.
I know. That's all the ironies of that, of her suddenly being thrust into that position, and How do you survive something like this also interested me. Because those, the one left behind to tell the story is the one who survived, which probably means that they were not as involved. And what is our legacy, those of us who are left behind in these major holocausts, say, that have happened in the 20th century, these major movements of populations, devastations, these totalitarian regimes, all these dead left behind in Latin America from all these military and dictatorship regimes, those who survive, what is their place? How do you make peace with this? Or I guess that's even a wrong question, or not an appropriate question. Make peace. How do you make meaning of it? And the need to tell a story in order to understand or come to terms with what's happened. I love at the Holocaust Museum in Washington D.C. the button that they give you. It doesn't say, you know, Holocaust Museum. It's a black button with white lettering, and all it says is remember. You know, and for me, that's what the story does.
Julia Alvarez, she's author of In the Time of the Butterflies, and as well as Yo and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent. We'll be back with her in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our interview with Julia Alvarez. I spoke to her just a few weeks ago up at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. She is a professor at Middlebury College and author of a number of books, including Yo, her latest, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, her first, and what we're talking about now, In the Time of the Butterflies.
You tell the story of the Mirabal sisters fighting against the Trujillo regime, and unfortunately in this country, I think there's very low level of knowledge about the Dominican Republic in general. Probably most people haven't even heard of Trujillo. Mm-hmm. But could you describe what he was doing at that time, why they rose up against them, and also their relationship with their husbands and their lovers and their comrades who were men, because you also deal a lot with male-female relations.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Trujillo regime is really one of the many regimes that happened in the early part of the century all over Latin America. We had the United States occupation from 1916 to 1924, and before the Americans left, they set up a government, and they left Trujillo as head of the national police. I mean, they had groomed this guy and trained him, he was, as the phrase goes, I don't know about what dictatorship, he was an SOB, but he's our SOB, you know. So he definitely, Trujillo was set up by the American occupation who had been in the country for, 8 years. And so he became a totalitarian dictator. I mean, there were a slow process, but from 1930 to 1961, the country was his kingdom. We had a secret police system, people disappearing, any kind of a comment or being dissatisfied with anything and voicing it, you were just a dead man. He took over most of the farmlands and industries, and you know, everything was really it was his estate, the whole country. And for many years, the United States backed him. I mean, they wanted him. He was their SOB. And then I think after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, I think the United States sort of started awakening to what might happen to all these right-wing dictatorships if they didn't allow democracy to happen in these countries. And then they turned against Trujillo. 1959, 1960 was when the pressure started to be applied, which only made him crazier. I mean, people say he must have been crazy to murder the Mirabal sisters, because that's really what brought him down. I mean, after that, the whole country said, if this can happen, forget it. And that's what really politicized the country. So I think that, you know, for a long time he was supported by the United States, and then there was a turnaround because of the fear of the communist takeover if they let this continue.
What politicized the Mirabal sisters? Why did they end up going to prison? Why did they fight so hard?
Well, that was the question that I asked myself. That's why I had to write the book, because it interested me, of course, in their instance, but just in general, what is it that politicizes people? You know, what is it that makes them, you know, have this kind of courage? And I found out, you know, that it's complicated, that there are many ways in which people are politicized. And certainly with the interviews that I conducted in the Dominican Republic, the people I spoke to, the children of the sisters that who had been murdered, all of these interviews, I really came to see that these were very different sisters, these three sisters, and that each one had gotten involved for her own set of reasons, complicated reasons, and sometimes not very good reasons. Like, for instance, the youngest one was a real, you know, coquette, and she loved the excitement and the romance of this organization. And she also fell in love with a man who was in it. So, you know, are those the right reasons? But still, you know, who knows what the reasons are for why we do things. She in a sense, for her own reasons, got involved, but became a real, I think, in the torture prisons, really deepened in her commitment, what she was doing there.
And then there was Minerva.
And then there was Minerva. Minerva was, in a sense, the one who was the hardest for me to write about, because she was there ideologically. I mean, she was politicized. It wasn't because so-and-so got her in it. It wasn't. She was the drive behind the men, too, in the underground. And one of the hardest things was everyone I interview, I would say, well, you know, how did she become this way? Oh, Minerva was always that way. Minerva was always that way. You know, she was always had that spirit. And that's great, but it's hard for a novelist because you can't show development. You can't show. But then within that commitment, there's complexity. You know, there's complexity about what that commitment means. And I think for Minerva, towards the end, she was starting to break in terms of what she was doing in this movement and what toll it was taking on her family, her whole family, because she had gotten them all involved. And one of the things that helped me, because in doing research for this, I didn't just do research by going to the Dominican Republic and reading up on that history. I did research on different political figures, especially women who have been important in the 20th century. And in terms of commitment and where it comes from, I read this book by Robert Coles about the integration of schools in New Orleans.
That's something funny. Go ahead.
The integration of schools, Robert Coles' book that he wrote about the integration of schools in Louisiana, in New Orleans. And he interviewed this key woman who had been the one who had broken through the picket lines. All their parents, all the white parents had taken their kids out of the school when it was integrated. And this one woman, she had finally come through, and she had been a PTA mother and all this stuff, but she finally decided, and she broke the picket line and took her two kids in. He was very intrigued by what had politicized this woman. And he tried to interview, and she was kind of evasive. And then finally she said, I'm going to tell you the real story. She said she had taken her kids out too, you know, and the two kids had been, you know, raising a racket at home. She was tired of them. And she said, finally, about the fifth day, she said, she pointed to the little boy. She said, that one over there, he broke my favorite greeting lamp. And I said, that's it. You guys are going to school tomorrow. And she took them to school the next day. And he was so aghast because she tells the story that she took them to school. She was going to take them in. She saw the picket line, but she was resolved. She broke through the picket line. And then all these other mothers started to pull their kids and go through the picket line. And she looked behind her, and there was a crowd following. In other words, I found out, you know, I was researching this. So there's one model, you know. And there was the model then of Benazir Bhutto, who had been under house arrest 5-6 years, and then was released, went to Amsterdam, and there was a big rally, and she had been under close house arrest for 5-6 years, and suddenly she's at this big rally and going all over different countries trying to promote her cause. And she had developed agoraphobia from being locked up, and she was terrified, panicked to be in crowds and in public. And she had to fight this feeling, because here she was a figure, you know, of a great heroic woman who had been such a symbol. And she was terrified at the tiniest things, like leaving her hotel room. And that also gave me another model of, you know, the complexity of heroism, you know. And that's what I started to understand about Eva Minerva, that was there too, that kind of fear and terror, which therefore makes the courage, courage.
We're talking to Julia Alvarez, novelist and poet. She's written 3 books. The book we're talking about right now is In the Time of the Butterflies, about the Mirabal sisters. When they died, you had a very touching end chapter, or coming near the end, where all of these people who had somehow witnessed some part of their story at the very end, their journey driving in a car at the end, came to the family to tell them what they had seen.
Mm. Well, that was hard. You know, you never know how you're going to write a novel. You never know how it's going to go. As a matter of fact, I started out as a poet, really, and one of the reasons I always thought I could never write a novel was that I had this illusion that you bought a clean notebook and you went from beginning to end and you knew where you were going. Well, I didn't know how I was going to deal with the murder. At first, I thought I would present the murder directly, you know, because the men who murdered the Mirabal sisters finally were brought to trial, so we have some sense of how they were killed and what those last moments were like. But there were also little witnesses here and there who had their story to tell and had told the stories to they or to members of the family. And I decided that that's how I would do the ending, that these people would all start to gather at the days and tell her stories about that last day. I think I don't know quite why I made that decision, but I wanted what the reader was left with was the sense of these storytellers coming together to keep them alive, rather than focusing on the maybe very dramatic moment of their death. I thought the omission would be more powerful of portraying the moment.
You have a very telling line at one point in the book where they is looking around. She is talking to her niece, Minu.
Minu, si.
And she's wondering, what did they die for? She's looking at what Minu is doing, Minerva's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's looking at what Dominican Republic looks like today.
Well, I think that's a very key question. And certainly up till the election last year, one that they asked herself very seriously, because after Trujillo was killed, when we had supposed democracy, what we had was the continual re-election of Balaguer, who was the puppet president under Trujillo, and who was there for 5 terms. And so it was Trujillismo, as people say, without Trujillo. And so for to see this travesty, that finally we have a democracy, we're a democratic nation, but what we have is the continuation of the past, still less and less so towards the end of his last regime, of his last, what are they if they're not regimes, his last term. But with Balaguer, people were still disappearing, journalists. There was still all the, none of the trappings of the Trujillo with the underground police, the black Volkswagens, all of this, but still the residue of that kind of a system. And in 1996, finally, Balaguer stepped down because we had the election of Leonel Fernandez, who was an exile. His family were exiled, like my family, and he was raised through high school in New York City, in Washington Heights. And we also had the vice president is Dede's son, Jaime David. So finally, and now Minu is second in the foreign ministry office.
Minu Minerva.
Minerva's daughter.
Mirabal's daughter.
Yeah, it's like this young generation who are now my generation people, because we have what is called in the Dominican Republic the lost generation. The lost generation are the generation of my parents. La generación perdida, they call them, because that was the generation where anybody who was talented, anybody who had charisma, who was gutsy, ended up or leaving or being co-opted by the regime and becoming one of them, or dead. You know, there's even a joke, enterrado, desenterrado. There's a play on the word tierra. You're either under the ground or gone from your ground, or, you know, grounded up, or, I mean, the three options. And so that generation was the lost generation. Many talented, skilled people. It was, everybody, he was so jealous of any kind of talent or power besides his own, that people were either co-opted or they had to leave or killed. So that generation is, you know, the my parents' generation. Now this new generation, we who grew up, you know, as children in the regime, but we're not formed by the regime. See, our parents' generation were formed in that regime. They lived all their lives under that regime. But we who hear the stories, and now that question I posed earlier, what is our responsibility? And now it's starting to happen. Slowly, it's going to take time, but it's starting to happen.
Which brings us to your family story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to, well, I don't know actually your family story mm-hmm. exactly, because I'm reading novels that you've written, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, and Yo, its sequel, if you will, mm-hmm. where you talk about, did you have three sisters?
Yeah, that's the way they always catch me. I say, no, it's fiction. And they say, but did you have three sisters? Well, yeah, I had three sisters. Well, did you come from the Dominican Republic? Oh, well, yes, I came from the Dominican Republic.
But that's also interesting in terms of the Mirabal sisters. Did you draw on your own experience?
Well, of course. I mean, when I found out that it wasn't just the three sisters, but there was a fourth sister who survived, I thought, I know the politics of an all-female family in a Latino culture. And I definitely know the dynamics that can happen when there's four of them. So I thought, if anybody can write this story, come on, I can do it. So certainly, the hard thing about it is that now with Garcia Girls and the Garcia family that still appears in Yo, and with the Mirabal book, people are saying, oh, she just writes about sisters. And some people even say, oh, she just writes about four sisters. So I have to live it down, yeah.
Well, from what I've gathered about your family and how the Garcia girls lost their accent, can you talk about what happened in 1960, how your father got involved with CIM, and how your father fought against Trujillo, and how that affected you and your sisters in coming here?
Well, I think we didn't realize. I mean, the amazing thing is that you can live in a place where it's a state of terror and be a child, and you pick up that something is wrong, that there's a tension, but you learn to live with it. You think that that's the way people live everywhere. As a matter of fact, I even the other day remembered this little moment when we were sitting at the breakfast table, and I remember my mother telling us a story about how in Germany there had been this terrible war and this terrible dictatorship, and there were children who went and betrayed their parents because they were hiding people who Hitler was against. And am I hearing that? And now thinking back on it, thinking, was she trying to tell us something? You know, she trying to tell us...
Tell you something.
Trying to tell us kids something. Yeah, me in particular with a big mouth. So you know, I've wondered about that. But we grew up not knowing what was going on. So suddenly one night,
You're listening to Julia Alvarez, and that big mouth did grow up to be a storyteller, grew up to be an author. And she is the author of In the Time of the Butterflies. Her latest book is called Yo, In the Time of the Butterflies, published by Plume. Yo, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Tomorrow we'll continue the conversation and talk about growing up Latina in the United States. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Thanks to Mario Murillo. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!